Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. My next guest is Dr. Justin Goldston. Dr. Justin Goldston is a professor of project and supply management at Penn State University. He is the author of multiple peer-reviewed journal articles focused on supply chain management and innovative technologies of critical success factors in ERP implementations, and is a five-time TEDx speaker where he discussed emerging technologies such as blockchain and artificial intelligence. Dr. Goldston has also led and assisted in developing supply chain management and business analytics programs at Georgetown University, Texas A&M University, North Carolina Wesleyan College, and has evaluated doctoral programs for the Department of Higher Education while serving on the Management Advisory Board at various higher education institutions. Welcome to the podcast, Justin.
Thank you. Thank you, Daniel, for having me.
Well, thanks so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast. I always start off asking my guest, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
I think that my story is a little bit different. I'm gonna have a lot of different stories, but I think that one of the biggest times I felt that I was in the trenches was whenever I wanted to make that shift into higher education. I was nearing the end of my doctoral studies, and I was a management consultant, and I was on the road a number of weeks out the year. And I was afraid, like many people, you know, afraid to make that shift, afraid of the unknown. And I just made that transition. Mm-hmm. You know, I just made the decision to make the transition and, you know, let the chips fall where they may. So it was more of a psychological thing, mm-hmm. right? And I think that, you know, I was doubting myself because, you know, I had a number of peers that, you know, received their doctoral degrees and had a difficult time getting into higher education, although I was, you know, in adjunct roles. You know, the adjunct roles don't pay the bills.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, that was my biggest deciding factor. But I think that that's a story for a lot of people within academia. You know, whether you're at the, you know, K-12 or if you're in, you know, higher education and within administration and you want to go to teaching, or if you're in teaching, you want to go to higher education or go to administration. There's a number of us within this discipline that, you know, that want to make that shift, but just afraid of the unknown.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about your work in the industry prior to teaching higher ed, and explain supply chain management for, I would say, the K-12 educator, in layman's terms.
Okay. So I spent a number of years as a management consultant working with primarily manufacturers and distributors around the world. If you have heard of Blue Buffalo, the pet food company, I worked with them whenever they were in startup mode. They were just sold to General Mills for billions of dollars. I was working with them when they were $100 million. You know, so that was an exciting experience. I worked with Intel as well as Siemens. Mm-hmm. And during my time with those organizations, I was working with them on digital transformations or implementing their enterprise resource planning applications. Mm-hmm. So within the higher education area, their LMSs. So the LMS of business. So I was working with them on implementing those, on establishing those processes within their organization. And from a supply chain management perspective, I think that a lot of people have heard the term for the first time since you know, February and March during mm-hmm. the pandemic, when you would turn on your TV and hear supply chain management on, you know, on the news stations because of shortages.
Yeah.
You know, with toilet paper and hand sanitizer and things like that. So let's just frame it like toilet paper. And so during the pandemic, we had a shortage of toilet paper. You know, we had a high demand of toilet paper. And that created what we refer to as disruptions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So within supply chain management, you know, we forecast products and we essentially guess how much toilet paper our Walmarts need, how much toilet paper our grocery stores need. Mm-hmm. And because of this spike, you know, because of external factors, the manufacturers, the Kimberly-Clarks, the Procter and Gambles were unable to meet that demand. Mm-hmm. So they were unable to produce these rolls and cases of toilet paper to meet that demand. And they were unable to get the paper pulp to produce these rolls of toilet paper to meet that demand. So if you amplify that to PPE, if you amplify that to hand sanitizer, if you amplify that right now, we have a problem with lumber. You know, in a building industry, because you know the interest rates are so low, a lot of people are trying to do DIY projects. There's a lot of developers that are building homes. Mm-hmm. So because of that demand, you know, the price of lumber has increased because there's not enough supply to meet that demand.
Yeah.
So that's the ongoing issue we deal with within supply chain management, and there's never a dull day. No. And there's never been a dull day since March for me.
Definitely.
Because there's a number of different disruptions from a global perspective as it pertains to supply chain management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the toilet paper story, it's funny because I'm seeing now that we're in a what you would call a third wave. You know, there's starting to be a shortage at the Costco where I live, at least. And I'm thinking, well, people know that the Costco and the Walmart, they aren't going to close down. But it just seems like the people have this mindset that,
right,
well, if there's spikes in cases, we still got to get toilet paper because I guess, you know, they think they don't want to go out. But
right.
I think the industry is probably better prepared. But, you know, I think there's going to be these waves when cases go up, people have started getting anxious and they start hoarding paper products.
Right, right. Yeah. So my forecast was incorrect because, you know, I said, you know, I was talking about these artificial spikes within the supply chain where these organizations were placing orders for all of these suppliers that were supplying toilet paper. Mm-hmm. So they said, okay, whichever one gives me the toilet paper first, you know, I'm fine. You know, yeah. So then I was thinking that all these organizations have pallets of toilet paper,
yeah,
you know, by October, November timeframe. But, you know, that prediction was incorrect because we have another wave coming,
yeah,
you know, so.
Yeah, the people will get enough. I mean, that's.
Yes, that's for sure.
But it's kind of like thinking back to like March and that basic human need thing, and that toilet paper was the one thing that everybody hoarded the most, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. So we talked a little bit in the pre-chat about, you know, K-12 educators, and so a lot of them are just feeling burnt out, especially if they're teaching remotely and they have children at home, or maybe they're teaching in a hybrid environment, but they have some students remote. And there are several K-12 educators that might be thinking now during the pandemic or maybe next school year about making the change to teaching higher ed, especially if they have some experience teaching higher ed or if they have a doctoral degree. How would you advise teachers that want to make that shift? And what kind of positions? I mean, you said adjunct positions don't pay the bills. So how easy is it to make that transition to, say, a professorship?
I would say the steps to make that transition do not occur overnight.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that for those that are currently in their doctoral studies, whether it is in the coursework or whether it is within, you know, during a dissertation, I say start now.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of doctoral students that I mentor. They wait until they have defended,
yeah,
to start looking for those roles. So I would say that you know, that differentiator, in my opinion, is to start while you are currently completing your degree. You know, start presenting at those conferences. Start collaborating with your peers on those peer reviewed journal articles. Mm-hmm. And I would say the most important part is to look for a mentor. Look for a mentor that's been through it. You know, I think that for those who have those doctoral degrees, you have to have situations and times where you have not seen eye to eye with your committee members. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I do explain to those that I mentor is you have to trust the system. Mm-hmm. Those individuals have been through the process. They understand the process and they understand the rigor that goes into completing a doctoral study. Mm-hmm. If it was easy, everyone would have one.
Yeah.
So I think that that's the biggest thing, but that mentorship was critical to my success within the industry. And again, the process does not occur overnight, but I will also say to just like I did in the first question, you have to make that shift. You have to make that jump. You have to believe in yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, I think all of us can say that, you know, you've had people within your life, within your careers that, you know, have doubted your decisions of going to higher education, doubted your decisions of pursuing a doctoral degree, you know, because of the statistics. You know, mm-hmm. there's only a certain percentage of people with a doctorate. You know, once you get the doctorate, those jobs aren't available, you know, so you have to believe in yourself and you have to push through because, you know, I think that persistence is very important and critical to success in getting into higher education.
Mm-hmm. So we also talked a little bit about your teaching approach during your courses. Now that you're teaching full time higher ed, and you know, prior you were just teaching adjunct, you know, one course a week. So tell me a little bit about the ties that you have to the industry and how you bring that in to the classes that you teach, what level classes that you teach, and also what you advise your students who are interested in going into the industry.
You know, based on certain institutions, that you have those research institutions, you have the teaching institutions. Penn State is a research institution. Mm-hmm. And I think that the differentiator for me is that I stay close with the industry. I stay close with the leaders of the industry. Mm-hmm. I kind of have the voice, what I refer to as that voice of the customer. So mm-hmm. I collaborate with the leaders of these organizations to understand, what are you looking for in an undergraduate? What are you looking for in a master's student? What are you looking for if you're in pharma? You know, what are you looking for in a doctoral student? You know, and I, because of some of the academic freedom that I have, I include that real life use cases into the curriculum of my courses. I think that that's very important. That is especially in my discipline where, you know, supply chain, as I said, supply chain is probably one of the most important disciplines right now. I explained in my classes, Amazon saved the world in March.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you have to think, Amazon sold books. Mm-hmm. Amazon started selling books and they just saved the world through supply chain management. Right. So I think that, you know, reaching out and tying in those real life companies that they can relate to, tying in the Amazons, you know, and the logistics models that Amazon has, mm-hmm. tying in the Teslas, you know, and the automation that Tesla has within their organization. You know, they're going to understand the importance of it, you know, and they understand that it's no longer futuristic. You know, this mm-hmm. artificial intelligence is no longer futuristic. It's here. Mm-hmm. You know, Netflix uses artificial intelligence. Amazon uses artificial intelligence. Yes, and artificial intelligence has been around since the 1950s, but now we are seeing, you know, more awareness. We're seeing how we can actually use it for good. That's my biggest thing. of using these technologies for good, for a positive impact, for a positive impact on the world. So, and that's one thing that I preach in that, or I talk about in the classes, in that, you know, yes, people are talking about how cool all this stuff is, mm-hmm. but we can use this for a positive impact. All of the issues we're having in the world, we can use technology to kind of mitigate these issues, the risk that we have. You know, we can use technology to fight global, you know, climate change and things like that. We can use artificial intelligence to fight these biases we have in the world. You know, we can use artificial intelligence to fight this diversity and inclusion, you know, and things like that. And people say, well, how are you going to do that? You know, but that's what I talk about. That's what I bring to the classroom. You know, and you have to make it. And the thing is, you have to make it interesting.
Yeah.
Especially for like freshmen. So for K-12, I can make blockchain interesting.
Yeah.
and that's the key. That's the key.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was thinking when you were mentioning AI and how it's helping people. You know, I read an article on a lot of these robots that, you know, usually you would just think are. You know, the home, what was that? The name of that robot that does.
Oh, Google Home, Amazon Alexa.
Yeah. Well, those ones that sweep the floor.
Oh, iRobot. I got one.
But they're also using those type of things for, you know, like the sporting, the centers, you know, sometimes that are in use or closed right now to keep those places, clean. And also sometimes for security.
Yes.
To minimize, you know, just having to have people there during the pandemic. And, but I think it's interesting how, I also read an article about, there are a lot of, jobs that, you know, by 2030 or in 2050 that we have currently that will be replaced by AI. And however, instructors and teachers, there's a very minimal chance that will be replaced by AI. So what do you think, when we think of that, like, maybe 30 years in the future, what type of just regular, I mean, we're thinking like agriculture, what is going to be most quickly replaced by AI? Agriculture, cleaning, those type of things.
So there's an emergence. So you brought up an excellent point in that I just wrote a chapter in a textbook for industrial automation for this university in Germany. Mm-hmm. And Germany, so for those in business, they've probably heard of Industry 4.0. And, you know, Industry 4.0 was first introduced in Germany. Mm-hmm. And they had this big, broad, you know, grand idea of integrated automation, integrated machinery, and things like that. And we're 10 years into Industry 4.0. And I would say that we're maybe 60% of that, 60% to their vision. Mm-hmm. But I think that we are approaching Industry 4.5 with the inclusion of machine learning, with the inclusion of artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And artificial intelligence is entering into the financial industry, mm-hmm. you know, to run analysis in terms of approving loans and things like that. It's being used within the industry for forecasting, mm-hmm. for analytics and things like that. But I think that in higher education, I think we're going to see artificial intelligence to identify at-risk students. Mm-hmm. So artificial intelligence is going to collect that demographic data, collect the grades for all these students, mm-hmm. right? And it's going to look for trends for students, and artificial intelligence may identify at-risk students before the student realizes it.
Hmm.
You know, so artificial, there's use cases for artificial intelligence within every single industry. Also, so at Penn State, we have a program called the AI Nittany Alliance, mm-hmm. and they performed a competition, and there's students that actually worked with the healthcare system at Penn State, where Penn State actually used artificial intelligence to, during the pandemic, you know, to identify, you know, potential risk and things like that. So artificial intelligence was being used during the pandemic. And I think that it had a big, artificial intelligence was a big input into, you know, identifying potential medications. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because as you can, I mean, it takes years to run this medication through trials and things mm-hmm. like that. But because artificial intelligence can run through, you know, thousands of records of data in seconds, literally seconds, you know, they're able to analyze data that would take humans months, if not years, mm-hmm. you know, in seconds. So it had a positive impact. AI had a positive impact from that perspective, mm-hmm. Even during the pandemic. Mm-hmm.
And do you know if it's helping with that Operation Warp Speed with the vaccine?
I am not sure about that.
Yeah.
Now you give me some more research to do.
Okay. You know, just the fact that, you know, humans are able to manage this working together at this rate of, you know, speed of light almost in getting, mm-hmm. things, you know, getting a vaccine ready as opposed to, you know, back in even 20 years ago. So
right.
You would think, you know, AI has something to do with that, but yeah, I mean, just the fact that, you know, those robotic surgeries, there's, you know, like you're saying, it's being used and everything, but I find that interesting and, you know, identifying at-risk students because, you know, that's usually an instructor or teacher's job. Sometimes we have, you know, like an RTI coordinator or some administrator at the school or a student support specialist who might be working with that data, but not all schools have funding to hire somebody like that, or, you know, not everybody has time. So, you know, if in 20 years or even 10 years, if we had AI that could determine those at-risk students, you know, that would be very, very helpful for schools. And, you know, I know there's programs that do some of that data pooling, but to have something that actually goes through the data even quicker than we currently have. So I also wanted to talk a little bit about your work on the Diversity and Inclusion Committee. And that you also are working with the Alumni Sustainability Institute at Penn State. So tell me a little bit about just what the Diversity and Inclusion Committee has been doing, you know, now since they shut down classes in March, and how, you know, your classes are looking, or people in general at Penn State in making just social justice education a priority.
So, yeah, I would say that there's a lot of different things. And so I would first start off by saying you first have to define what is your definition of diversity and inclusion, mm-hmm. and also what is your definition of sustainability, mm-hmm. right? And I always start off with that question. And that's what we started off with whenever we began this diversity and inclusion committee, mm-hmm. because it can mean a number of different things. And I think that one of my fellow professors said that there's about 11 categories or something. Mm-hmm. I think like 9 or 11 categories. I don't know. Don't quote me on that one. But there's a number of different categories. And whenever you as an organization or as an institution look to adopt a diversity and inclusion initiative, mm-hmm. you know, I think that, you know, you either have to break up in teams and tackle 2 or 3, or as a group, you tackle the top 2 or 3 within your institution or organization. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the starting point for that is to get the voice of the customer, get the voice of the students, get the voice of your workforce, mm-hmm. of what's important to them. Also, you want to get the voice of the consumers themselves of what's important to them, because from a organizational perspective, that could be a competitive advantage, mm-hmm. for your company. If you're able to address the needs of your consumers, if you are able to address and highlight the things that are important to them, you know, you can make a positive impact on the bottom line, and 2, you make a positive impact on the world. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now that's another thing that takes me into the Sustainability Institute at Penn State, in that that's one of our main things where, you know, whether we had, because we have a number of people, you know, we have a number of environmentalists, we have individuals from the Smill College of Business, we have a number of individuals from Project and Supply Chain Management. It's interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very important because now you get different perspectives from individuals. Mm-hmm. You have different, you know, you have those that have that focus on the planet. You have those that have a focus on diversity and inclusion. You have those that have a focus on, you know, the oceans and things like that. So if you look at the UN Sustainability Development Goals, there's a number of Sustainability Development Goals. And I always, for every single one of my classes, I always ask my students, I say, pick your top. What's your top two? Mm-hmm. What's your top two? And my top two are essentially innovation and education. Mm-hmm. And innovation and education are important to me because if I educate individuals on sustainability, if I educate individuals on social responsibility, if I educate individuals on social justice, if I educate individuals on environmental justice, now I can use technology to address all of the other issues mm-hmm. within those sustainability development goals. Mm-hmm. You know, so I always say that, you know, it depends on how you define it. It depends on how you look at it. What's your perspective?
Yeah.
You know, because we all have different priorities.
Yeah. No, I think bringing that up, having that set of goals to relate to, especially when you're discussing that with your students, mm-hmm. Because those are very clearly laid out, right? And I remember
absolutely
4 or 5 years ago, and you know, going through that, how do you you know, discuss that in class with students, even whether you're teaching foreign language, language arts, or social studies? So. Yeah, it depends how you look at it, like you said, what you want to focus on for those sustainability goals. We talked a little bit in the pre-chat as well about positive things that have come out of the pandemic for you. You were before the pandemic, you were doing TED Talks, you were traveling a lot, but you have said that you've gotten a lot of opportunities mm-hmm. recently that you otherwise would not have gotten with people in different countries. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, so I was first contacted by an organization in Singapore to deliver a keynote mm-hmm. for their Global Women in Supply Chain conference. You know, so that's two of the things that are right down the alley in terms of supply chain management and as well as diversity and inclusion, and that one conference essentially led to, you know, other conferences where I spoke in Asia. I spoke in, you know, in China or virtually in Asia, in China. I have a conference where I'm going to speak at a conference in Europe. I was just contacted to last Thursday to come to go speak at a conference in South Africa, you know, and it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. In that we think that we have problems here in terms of diversity and inclusion, and we think we have problems here in terms of sustainability. And they kind of, those people from different, like from India, from mm-hmm. Bangladesh, they kind of scoff and say, okay, so what? Like, do you understand our problems, what we have? You know, and so it's very eye-opening, very eye-opening. In that it's good to get a different perspective. It's good to collaborate with, because another important thing is that these conferences are getting like the global leaders mm-hmm. on the topic. You know, so I'm speaking at a conference with people who I read their books. Yeah. I read their textbooks. I cited these people in my peer-reviewed journal articles. I cited these people in my dissertation. You know, and so, for example, I did a sustainability and supply chain conference in, like I said, in the Asia Pacific region. And I cited a MIT study from Dr. Alexis Bateman. I got to call her home Friday to talk about a collaboration project.
Wow.
Right. It's unbelievable. And I would say that, and that's what I explained to a lot of people. I just had a conversation with a doctoral student in Australia. Mm-hmm. You know, and I explained to her that we wouldn't be talking if if it weren't for this pandemic, I'd be traveling. We'd both be too busy to talk. I wouldn't be on this podcast probably if it wasn't for the pandemic, to be honest. You know, I'd be too busy to even reach out. You know, so I would say that to me, that's the silver lining. And again, this opened my eyes to get that global perspective, mm-hmm. you know, supply chain management of diversity and inclusion, of sustainability. Because like when I spoke to that individual in Australia, we have very similar research interests, you know, with supply chain technology and sustainability. But she said, well, because we import a lot of our products, like we don't manufacture here in Australia, we import everything. But we import from Bangladesh and India. Mm-hmm. So we have a huge problem with modern day slavery in our supply chains. Mm-hmm. So that's her research. That's her primary research. Her primary research is to eliminate modern day slavery, mm-hmm. you know, around the world, you know, and find ways in which how we can do that. You know, and there was one topic at that conference last week where one individual said that, you know, there's more slaves now than ever before in history.
Yeah.
You know, and that was eye-opening for me. You know, and again, you know, we have to raise the awareness of it. And I think that we as individuals within higher education, you know, have the platform too. You know, raise the awareness, because we're teaching future leaders. We're coaching future leaders, mm-hmm. you know, and it's kind of that trickle down effect where these leaders are going to be leading tens of thousands of people, you know, and they're going to be developing these sustainable environments within their organizations. And that's where it starts. That's mm-hmm. where it starts.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting perspective on how, well, not only you've been able to connect with these people from around the world, but also seeing how they, you know, like we say, we have problems with our supply chain and so on and so forth. But, you know, to them, you know, our problems are minuscule, right? And also, you know, how like
toilet paper.
Yeah. Well, how also that Australian student is, she's experiencing this directly.
Exactly.
Modern day slavery is affecting what they import to Australia. And, you know, I think, like you said, a lot more opportunities to connect with people from around the world and collaborate with these online conferences, but also making, you know, those contacts and, you know, having things like this podcast, having things like YouTube sessions and learning. I think this, you know, during this period of time, I've probably participated in a lot more professional development than I ever have previously, right? And I've also, you know, done a couple of conferences where I've had breakout sessions for virtual conferences as well. But you know, it's just not only is a lot cheaper or free professional development, it's also there's just so much more at your fingertips, right? Because you would have to travel to it before. So out of everything we talked about on the podcast today, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
I would say that because my mindset is, you know, making the shift, you know, I'm here because I took the chance, because I made the shift. Mm-hmm. I think that my primary takeaway is, you know, you should challenge the status quo and think unconventionally. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, I didn't take the traditional route to higher education. I would say that my teaching approach is not the traditional method, but I mean, it works for me. The yeah. students love it because the students like that real life application. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, I say that I just did this one conference in Singapore. Mm-hmm. I said, here it is. I said, this is what we talked about last week in class. Yeah. What we said about last week in class is what I'm talking about the leaders around the world. Mm-hmm. You know, so you know, it's not theory; it's practical application, and it's things that organizations can implement. It's things that students can take with them as they progress throughout their careers.
Yeah. And where can people find you online and connect with you?
I would say the easiest place to find me is on LinkedIn. I frequent LinkedIn often. So that would be the best place to reach out to me.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast. It was great having you on today.
Yes, thank you for having me. Thank you for the opportunity.